Shining a light on a shady part of doing business, a longtime reporter is exposing the global corporate bribery network. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton goes around the world with an author who has covered corporate bribery for years. That starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. Let's say you wanted to build a high-rise apartment building, and you needed some help clearing the paperwork and the red tape. Now, there are two ways to look at the offer of gifting a $50 million penthouse apartment in that building. First, incredible largesse and a show of epic generosity. Second, the giver might want something in exchange for that gift. The second take, in a more macro way, is the subject of a new book on corporate bribery titled Kickback.
There's also the possibility that some of the compromat, the supposed compromising material that the Russians may hold over President Trump, involves information about his shady business deals in Russia.
This week, we talk with an author and journalist about his experience covering and exposing corporate bribery. Corporate bribes are one of the most pressing human rights and political issues of our time. Yet, commercial bribery is both perceived by the public and prosecuted by U.S. law enforcement as if it were merely insider trading with no acknowledgement of bribery's lasting social harm. This is part one of two with the author of Kickback for the broadcast. A full extended interview is in the podcast version. You can grab that wherever you get your podcasts. Just keyword search Techonomics. Okay, here we go.
I'm David Montero. I'm the author of Kickback.
The subtitle is Exposing the Global Corporate Bribery Network. Let's just start there. Let's start with a working definition of foreign corporate bribery.
Yes, this is a crime that involves a corporation. Any corporation that issues stock on a U.S. stock exchange is prohibited from paying bribes overseas to a government official in order to gain some kind of competitive advantage. Okay. And usually that means to win a contract, but it can mean any kind of competitive advantage.
Let's go into a couple of anecdotes first, because I know one of the premises of the book is that corporate bribery is more, in your view, a human rights issue rather than a fiscal crime. And I definitely want to dig into that. But could you tell us a little bit about, I don't know, we could pull one out of a hat here. How about Chevron and Shell? What was that about? And this decade of pursuit that's been going on.
Chevron and Shell have obviously quite a large oil presence in Nigeria, one of the most oil-rich countries in the world. And Chevron in particular has a plant in the Niger Delta called at a place called Escrevos. And in the period of 2001-2002, there was quite a lot of violence. Ethnic communities in that region were upset that oil companies from abroad had come and were taking oil out of the ground from their land, essentially, but not sharing the profits. Violence ensued, and Chevron's plant actually had to be shut down for almost a year. Chevron lost $1 billion as the wells literally went dry. And in the middle of all this, there was a very shady governor named James Ibori, who was the governor of the Delta State. And he had a little houseboat company that was sort of floating around in all this. And he negotiated a peace between all these ethnic clans on behalf of Chevron and Shell. And as soon as he did that and their oil wells came back online, millions of dollars started flowing into the bank account in London of James Ibori's little houseboat company. And that naturally raised some questions in Nigeria. Well, why, of all the houseboat companies in Nigeria, are Chevron and Shell, at the moment that their wells just got turned back on, why are they paying that company in London millions of dollars, almost $4 million in a period of 3 years? Mm-hmm. What made it even more suspicious was how the money was used. In a legitimate business, that money would have gone back into the business. It would have maybe bought more houseboats or repaired the existing houseboats. In the case of this little houseboat company that Chevron and Shell paid, the money was used to buy Ibori a $420,000 Maybach limousine.
Oh.
It was used as a down payment on a private plane. Ibori bought a very nice 7,000-square-foot mansion in Houston, Texas, all in cash. It looked very suspicious that that this houseboat contract was more than a houseboat contract. And that's exactly the point. That's how bribery works in the modern world. It's never a guy goes to another guy and hands him money under the table. It's not that elaborate. These are pretty sophisticated players, both the corporations and the officials who are receiving the money. So they concoct schemes that look very innocuous, very legitimate on paper. But if you start to dig, there's a lot of red flags, the main one being a company like Chevron should have done due diligence mm-hmm. on a company like this houseboat company and realized this is owned by the governor of the state where we're doing business. This is just inappropriate.
We're speaking with David Montero, author of Kickback, Exposing the Global Corporate Bribery Network. You've been covering this a long time. You did extra research for the book. It reads like kind of a whodunit sometimes. So I'm not going to stay with the anecdotes too long. I've got one eye on the clock. I only have you for about 10 more minutes. I'd like to talk about prosecution and investigation. There seems to be a really low conviction rate around this crime. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, as we've seen across the board in white-collar crimes, there's a very low conviction rate of individual executives. What the Justice Department would argue is that in the case of foreign corporate bribery, it's particularly complicated and difficult to show the particular criminal intent of an employee. Why? These are crimes that take place often long ago, and they take place abroad. The evidence is abroad. The witnesses who can speak to that evidence are often abroad. So it's difficult for the Justice Department to gather that and then bring to trial that evidence and convince a jury this particular executive criminally was intent on bribing this person. That's what they say. And there is some truth to that. These are difficult cases to bring. And juries do have a difficult time understanding bribery and how it works. But I think the more important issue is that it's hard, and the Justice Department doesn't want to lose at trial. It's suffered a few very public, humiliating defeats at trial, trying to bring charges against an executive. I think since then they've come up with a format where it's much easier to just settle with the corporation, get a fine. That right. is their method of deterrence. We will fine these companies.
But they never have to admit wrongdoing. The corporations never have to admit wrongdoing.
Yeah. It depends. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they actually plead guilty to charges.
Okay.
But it's more rare that they just they will acknowledge. That is the language sometimes used. They acknowledge, you know, what the Justice Department has laid out in the charges, and do not either admit or deny it. But the fine, they pay the fine and they move on.
Right.
And that's a system that's working for everybody except the people who are suffering the consequences.
Just as a quick side note, David, do you know where those fines go when they're paid? Who gets it?
Very good question. It all goes to the U.S. Treasury. So since 2006, the Justice Department has levied $12 billion in fines against corporations for this particular crime of bribery. All that money has gone to the Treasury Department. Now, that's fine, but the problem with that is that the people who suffer the consequences of these bribes are the citizens of the foreign countries where these bribes are paid. They don't see any of that money. So there's quite a debate, as you can imagine, around how the Justice Department can and should mandate that some of this money goes to the countries where the bribes are paid as a reparation.
Yeah, as a reparation, it's a great word. And I want to come back to that. But you mentioned Justice Department. I want to drill into that a little bit. Didn't the Justice Department have a pretty major win in the 70s with Watergate, with corporate bribery, the shell corporations? I mean, everybody thinks about the plumbers and the break-in, but it really was more about slush funds, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's what we discovered after what Ray Garrett, the head of the SEC at the time, called the second half of Watergate, and by far the larger half. We discovered as a result of the investigations in Congress that corporations were not only secretly funding political campaigns in the United States like Nixon's, but more importantly, they were paying the equivalent in today's dollars of billions of dollars to foreign governments around the world, and including in countries that were supposed to be our allies, like Japan or the Netherlands or Italy. And we have never had such a poignant moment of really addressing the issue as right after Watergate. The SEC actually created an amnesty program where companies could admit to their bribery and receive lesser fines for doing so. And something like 600 companies came forward and said, yes, okay, we were doing this. So it was a win in the sense that it took the lid off of this crime. 117 of those companies that came forward were Fortune 500s. So it really put bribery on the map, so to speak.
At the end and the bigger part of Watergate started a new look at corporate bribery. I have to ask the question, is there anything we can pull forward from history to present day? Because there is a special counsel working right now.
Yeah, I find it interesting. I think, based on my read and based on, I mean, we're all reading the tea leaves at this point. No one really knows what's going on in Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the elections. But it seems to me that bribery is very much floating in and around this whole investigation. And I say that because if you look at the Trump Tower meeting, this infamous meeting between Trump's son and some of his associates and people connected to the Russian government, it seems that this meeting was set up to be a quid pro quo. Trump's organization, because he wasn't yet president, but his organization and he was a candidate, were offering something to Russian government officials. Namely, if you help me get elected president, I will soften sanctions against Russia. And who knows what else may have been promised. It looks something like a quid pro quo. Trump, the head of a sprawling business organization, is offering some kind of promise to a foreign government official, and that promise may result in something that would give his business in turn quite an advantage if he's elected president. We don't know how this all played out, but I think that that's something that could be floating in the middle of what Robert Mueller is investigating. Certainly some of the people on his team are experts in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act,
yes,
the law that we have that prohibits bribery. Are they looking at this from that angle? Possibly. There's also the possibility that some of the compromat, the supposed compromising material that the Russians may hold over President Trump, involves information about his shady business deals in Russia. All these real estate deals that he pursued and which may be connected to dirty money. So one wonders if that's not floating around somewhere in the investigation that Robert Mueller is now pulling apart.
You know, I was reading Kickback, David, and I have here in my notes, I quote, these are in quotes, a bribery forensics team. Do you think that there needs to be a shakeup at the SEC, FTC, Justice Department? Is there a smarter way law enforcement could address this?
I think the smarter way to do this is to start looking at the impact of this crime, which is something that the SEC and the Justice Department have not done. They prosecute this crime as if it were any other white-collar crime. Companies are held to account for filing false paperwork. Smarter way to do this, figure out a way to incorporate into the fines and into the settlements that these bribes have an impact. That, I think, could result in higher fines. It could result in more deterrence if companies realize the impact of this crime and are held to account for it.
The one you mentioned at the top, the Chevron and Shell thing out of London, that's still ongoing, I think, right? And it's been going for 10 years.
Yeah, it's the largest corruption case in the history of the UK against this former governor I mentioned, James Ibori. It is winding down. James Ibori was convicted at trial, but the UK is still struggling to figure out how much money he stole from Nigeria and hid in real estate and other things in the UK. And that is ongoing and may go on for years.
Let's circle back to the reparations thing to finish our conversation. It's very clear that you see this. The exposure of the global corporate bribery network is not necessarily delineated well, or reparations. Human rights versus fiscal crime. Let's dig into the human rights aspect of it. What do you see there, and how can we better address that?
I think it's a human right that people have a right to live free of corruption. Especially people who are in a foreign country have a right to live free of the corruption of a corporation based in another country. When a corporation pays a bribe to a government official, it induces them to specifically and intentionally violate the rights of its citizens to live free of that corruption. And it induces that official to forsake their job. That's the first way in which I think this is a human right. The second way is the impact of these bribes, either because they fuel conflict, sometimes they fuel terrorism, they undermine public health, they undermine fiscal governance and stability. Those are other ways in which this affects average citizens and their human rights, either economically in terms of their health or in terms of the environment, the political stability of the environment in which they live. So I think we need to address that by acknowledging this impact. It's almost as if we have, you know, we've had this crime for 400 years, ever since there were corporations. We've never looked at the impact of that. It's like saying, you know, we have guns and people shoot them, but we never look at what happens to the people who are shot. What's the result of the shooting? Well, people die. People are maimed. People are hurt. Yeah. In bribery, we have to start looking at the impact, too.
You mentioned the British East India Company very early on in the book as establishing the landmark, the benchmark, if you will, of how best to do corporate bribery abroad.
Exactly, yeah, and it starts back then, yeah.
I have 1 minute left. I'm going to ask you about Silicon Valley-centric question. I don't think Amazon had to bribe anybody to get its HQ2s because it got all those tax breaks and everything else. Anything in the tech industry that we're using now, are companies exposed to this possibility of global corporate bribery?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, companies, think about it. You know, the markets for telecom and software and other tech products are huge in emerging markets like China or Bangladesh. And in fact, companies that work in the telecom space or companies like IBM have paid fines for paying bribes in places like Korea. So, yes, I think tech companies, it's more under the radar. We tend to think of bribery as something that, you know, happens in mining and oil, but it happens in software. It happens with mobile phones and
right.
things that are tech-related, certainly.
Rare earth minerals and things like that, I imagine, too.
Mm-hmm.
David Montero, author of Kickback, Exposing the Global Corporate Bribery Network. This has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was David Montero. His new book is titled Kickback, Exposing the Global Corporate Bribery Network. David Montero has documented the impact of corruption in South and Southeast Asia, formerly a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and a regular producer for PBS's flagship investigative series, Frontline. His work has twice been honored with an Emmy Award nomination, as well as the South Asian Journalist Association's Daniel Pearl Award. Montero has also written for The New York Times, The Nation, Le Monde Diplomatique, and many others. For links to his book and to the other sources and resources around corporate bribery, please check the show notes that go with this week's show. The story lives at KGORadio.com. And that's going to do it for this week's show. We hope you liked the guest and the subjects as much as we enjoyed putting them together. For this and all of our archived podcasts, you can check iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Audio Boom, just about everywhere you get your podcasts. Just keyword search Techonomics. We are also online at several convenient locations near you. KGORadio.com/Techonomics, Facebook.com/Techonomics Radio, and I'm on the Twitters. I'm at KGO Jason. For executive producer Lee Hammer, I'm the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. Thanks again for listening, and have great weeks, everybody.